From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. I'm sitting in for Terry Gross, who's on vacation. On today's Fresh Air, I speak with Dean Stockwell. The child of a show business family, he starred in 22 films by the time he was 15. Stockwell dropped out of Hollywood twice. Now he's back with roles in Tucker and Married to the Mob. Also today, a journey into chaos with science writer James Glick. Chaos is a new scientific theory that explains the shape of coastlines, our changing climate, and why you get clouds in your coffee when you add cream. Commentator Maureen Corrigan reviews Writing Red, the first anthology of women's fiction, poetry, and reporting of the 1930s, much of it fervent and radical. And rhythm guitarist and singer Marty Gross treats us to a song by Fanny Bryce. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. The first movie in which Dean Stockwell starred at the age of 7 was opposite Frank Sinatra and Gene Kelly in Anchors Away. One of his famous childhood films is The Boy with Green Hair, a pacifist film from 1948. He dropped out of the Hollywood scene in the early 60s, only to return acting in films which earned him Best Actor awards from the Cannes Film Festival, as one of the Bright Boy Leopold and Loeb murderers in Compulsion, co-starring with Orson Welles, and for his role as the tubercular Edmund in Long Day's Journey Into Night with Katharine Hepburn and Jason Robards. My guest today on Fresh Air is now in his third movie career, after again dropping out of the Hollywood world several years ago. Like many child actors, he found other work, and 6 years ago earned his real estate license in New Mexico. He ran an ad in Variety for his real estate services. Instead, he got calls inviting him to play roles in Dune and Paris, Texas. In 1986, he was the suave drug dealer Ben with the white pancake makeup and cigarette holder, doing the vamp lip-sync version of Roy Orbison's In Dreams in David Lynch's Blue Velvet. And he's now starring as the suave mafia don Tony the Tiger LaRusso in Jonathan Demme's crime story comedy Married to the Mob. Dean Stockwell, thanks for joining us on Fresh Air today.
My pleasure. Good morning, good day, good evening. Hello to everybody.
Hey, Married to the Mob, you seem to be enjoying the work and the movie a great deal.
Yes, I enjoyed doing the role of this mafia don more than any role I've ever done. It was my number one favorite.
But you look so natural and you even sound so suave. It was a cigar-smoking mafioso. Is this a suaveness something natural to you? Are you suave at home?
No. No, it's a character. But it seemed to come very naturally to me. In all my years in film, I've never played a character that had any Italian blood. And I'm half Italian. And I think that may have something to do with it. And also, it's a figure of great power and threat of danger, and yet he's charming and sexy and likable.
Well, you play a character with a wandering eye and a wandering gun.
Yes. Mostly wandering eye. The gun is he's a pretty straight shooter.
You once said that you could work without directors, and in fact some directors could hurt you. But I get the sense that directors like David Lynch, who directed you in Blue Velvet, and Jonathan Demme have been very good for you.
Yes, but what I'm saying there is that I work best if I come to a meeting of minds with a filmmaker before we start, then if I'm just, as it were, let alone to go ahead and do what we've agreed to do, then it's going to come out just fine. And that's the way we work together, Jonathan Demme and David Lynch and Wim Wenders and Francis Coppola and Dennis Hopper, all of the directors I've worked with recently. They let me do my thing, as the saying goes.
Working with Jonathan Demme on a project, I hear, is kind of like being at a big party.
Yes, Jonathan has this unique, it's part and parcel of his way of working. He includes in his operation the notion that everyone is to have a good time and have fun, but it's not an end in itself. It's a means to an end, so it doesn't get in the way of the business at hand, and you end up with a movie that doesn't mean anything because everyone was just having a party. It's not that. Mm. It's just that he wants everyone on a certain level of enjoyment, but he also insists that the work get done in a very professional manner.
Jonathan Demme wanted you to read for the part, but you refused. How come?
Well, I wanted to do the part very much. I really fell in love with it. And in my entire career, I've never gotten the part that I read for. So I think after a while, it's safe to say, if it dawns on you that your statistics are, you're batting zero for 500 or something, that you might as well not even try it.
So I told
Jonathan that I couldn't read for it, and I just talked to him about it and told him my approach to it and what I wanted to do with it and what I thought I could do with it. And he had that amount of trust for me and let me do it.
So how did you get the parts that you've had? And you've had a lot of them. I mean, if you've never read for them.
Well, the ones we're talking about are the ones that people have seen, and those are all, they've all been offered to me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In Blue Velvet, one of the most memorable scenes is that where Dennis Hopper and you as Ben are together at the whorehouse, and you are wearing a brocaded jacket. And
it's funny, everyone thinks it's a whorehouse. No, it was never established, and it's not in the script, and no one ever said or thought that it was a whorehouse. It's odd.
What was it? Was it something else? Or was
it was
just unspecified?
It was a pad, just where the guy lived, and those were his weird friends.
Well, you kept good company then. But there was something about that scene. You had, I think, probably no more than a dozen lines in it, mm-hmm. and you were in large part a foil to what Dennis Hopper's manic energy in that. But it was one of the most memorable scenes of the entire movie. How much did you prepare for that? Did David work with you on that scene? How much of it was sort of your imagination that you brought to the script?
No, that was all mine. There's no description of Ben. That's the character's name. There's no description of him in the screenplay. And after I read it, I figured out what I was going to do, and I called David and said, here's what I'd like to do, and he said, great. And so I came. I did the makeup, I did the wardrobe, and the whole thing.
And including
so, you know, I've got a weird imagination. What can I tell you?
And including the music, the Roy Orbison in Dreams, was that your choice, too?
No, that was David's.
Yeah. Dennis Hopper looked so sweet singing along with you. He was truly, truly moved by your performance into that.
Oh, yes. That's my boy, Dennis. I just did a picture with Dennis.
Which one?
It's called Backtrack. He's directed it and he stars in it. It's Dennis and Jodie Foster and myself and Joe Pesci and Vincent Price and a bunch of wonderful people. And that should be coming out probably in the next spring.
My guest is actor Dean Stockwell. He plays the Mafia Don Tony the Tiger Russo in Jonathan Demme's new film, Married to the Mob. Stockwell also plays the part of Howard Hughes in the film Tucker. As a young actor, especially after portraying one of those intellectual Leopold and Loeb murderers, you became kind of a mail drop for psychotic scripts, and now you're playing the characters that just kind of angle off the planet. Are you comfortable being out there?
Yes, I'm comfortable. I like doing things with a wide variety, and that's the kind of things that I've been fortunate enough to get. I haven't been in a position where I've been turning things down. I don't have stacks of scripts to pick and choose. The ones that come have been, thank God, wonderful, interesting, and very, very divergent things.
What did your career as a child actor do to you? Did you miss your childhood?
Well, my childhood was a working childhood, so there were aspects of childhood that I missed, and that presented a lot of difficulties. But I have no regrets now. I have my own children, young children now, 3 and 5 years old. And my beautiful wife, Joy, is a great mother. And now I have a great deal of motivation, and I'm goal-oriented toward my family. And I feel very fulfilled now.
Are you going to keep your children away from the movie business?
Well, I don't know if that'll ever even come up. I would encourage my children to enjoy their childhood. I don't see any reason for them to work as opposed to play.
How did you fight the perception of being a former child star in your career? I mean, you were a very cute kid. You didn't fight it.
No, I didn't fight it. I grew up, and I've always appreciated being remembered for work I did as a child. Some of the things that I did, I have a measure of pride about. Boy with Green Hair, I've always felt proud of that film and several others. I didn't do too many what I would consider stupid films. I was the one of the children that were starring in films that was doing the more serious type of films. That's just, it was my lot. That's what fell into my lap.
Well, we have an excerpt from The Boy with Green Hair, a scene that you're doing with Pat O'Brien, who's playing your gramps. And I don't know when was the last time you heard or saw the film.
Oh, it's been a few years.
Yeah. This is a scene from The Boy with Green Hair from 1948.
I don't want green hair. I want my own color back.
Now, let's not be too hasty, lad. It's a grand color. Why are you always ready to think the worst? Maybe it's something good.
Something good?
Well, like a mark or something, a medal, maybe.
What would I get a medal for? I haven't done anything.
Well, that's perfectly true. You haven't done anything at all. But you're still young. You're still young, and maybe this medal is for something you're going to do.
But what is it I'm going to do?
That remains to be seen. But it'll be very interesting to find out. And you mark my words, it'll be something grand.
Do you really think so, Graham?
Oh, I do, lad. I do indeed. Come on, I'll eat your breakfast.
That was from 1948. You were 12 at the time. Did you feel marked then for something special? Was that scene...
Well, I was 11. The film was released later on. No, I didn't feel marked for something special. I felt that I was being treated as something special then, and I didn't like it, and I wanted to get out of it.
Mm-hmm. What drove you out of it, finally? Out of the world of Hollywood? Just that being treated special?
I don't know about the world of Hollywood. Other words, wherever I went, I was treated as something different.
Mm-hmm.
My peers of my own age were antagonistic. You know, children can be kind of mean. And they didn't like me because I was something different. So I didn't have a peer group. And the people that I worked with were adults who at one moment would treat me as a child and insist that I remember that I was a child. And at the next minute would expect an adult level performance and type of work. So it was almost deranging. It's psychologically a very difficult atmosphere to grow up in. And by the time when I graduated high school, when I was 16, I had to get away from it. That's what I did.
So how'd you get away with it? Did you take off, hit the road, change your
name? Yeah, I physically left, yes. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And I did change my name, and I had been known as a child on the screen, and now I was 16, 17, 18, so no one knew who I was. And that's what I was seeking. I wanted to feel what anonymity was like. And it was very beneficial. I don't really think I would have survived if I hadn't left. And also I had the great good fortune to have a very loving and understanding mother who was protective and looking after my interests. And some other children that were in the same position had less understanding parents that sort of pushed them and forced them to perform.
Your parents were also show business people, so your mother was not a typical stage mother, a pushy stage mother.
No, not at all. And my parents had separated when I was six, so it was her responsibility.
So then you came back to acting, both stage and in New York and in Los Angeles. What brought you back off of the road?
Well, by the time I was 20, almost 21, it was clear to me that I didn't have any training to do anything else. So I attempted to try it again. And I was fairly successful and fairly lucky to be successful. Things happened fairly well. And I made a series of films that now, in retrospect, were important projects.
You participated in the story of another family, O'Neill's Long Day's Journey Into Night. And you starred with Katharine Hepburn and Ralph Richardson and Jason Robards. And you were Edmund, the tubercular boy. Was this a role that you just sort of were able to walk right into and sense how you wanted to play it?
Yeah, that's the only way I can do. That's the way I work. I just, when I read something, my first impressions bring about 80% of what I'm going to do. And then the remaining 20% come as I'm shooting the picture or in preparation for it. and that involves embellishments and detail and choices like that. But the real substance of what I'm going to do comes to me when I first read it. And that's invariably what I do and go for.
This is a scene from Long Day's Journey in Tonight where Edmund has just returned from the doctor who's given him the diagnosis.
You haven't asked me what I found out this afternoon. Don't you care a damn?
Don't say that. You hurt me, dear.
What I've got is serious, Mama. Doc Hardy knows for sure
that
now.
That lying old quack. I warned you he'd invent something.
He called in a specialist to examine.
Don't tell me about Dr. Hardy. If you heard what the doctor
sure.
at the sanatorium, who really knows something, said about how he treated me, said it was a wonder I hadn't gone mad. I told him I had once, that time I ran down in my nightdress to throw myself off the dock. You remember that, don't you? And you want
yes,
me to pay
sir.
Attention to what Dr. Hardy says? Oh, no.
Listen, Mama. I'm going to tell you whether you want to hear it or not. I've got to go away to a sanatorium.
You're there with Katharine Hepburn.
There's a little bit of light comedy for you folks. Oh, boy. What fun. Yes?
So are you feeling stereotyped by what we've been presenting today?
No, not at all. Good. It's all good. Very different.
Yeah. No, it is all very different. I mean, and part of the sense that came out in looking at Long Day's Journey in Tonight, in that production from 1962, you played Edmund as a tranquil center within a family that was just fraught with addiction, both psychological and alcohol and drugs. You were sort of the calm center of that production.
Yeah.
Do you remember talking that over with Katharine Hepburn in that particular scene? How you worked
no.
that out?
No. No, I talked things over with Sidney Lumet, and, you know, he would talk to me. We rehearsed that for 4 weeks as a play before we started to shoot it, or 6 weeks. It was either 4 or 6 weeks, because it was shot as a play, and it's 3 hours long. At least the original version was. I don't know if it's ever been chopped for television. And it doesn't vary from the text of the play. So you can't approach it as a normal film. You have to rehearse it as written as a play. And during that process, during that 6 weeks, everything was discussed.
There was a second time when you dropped out of the world of filmmaking in the 60s, in the early 60s.
Yeah.
You were hanging out with Jack Nicholson and with Dennis Hopper and Eric Clapton. And what was it more of a search rather than an escape at that time?
It wasn't a search. If I had been looking for something, it sort of came to me because it's the revolution that happened in the 60s. You couldn't avoid it. It just started happening everywhere. And it seemed to represent to me maybe something that I had missed in childhood, the freedom of it and the creativity of it. So I wanted to quit working professionally and participate in that, and I did. And again, I have no regrets about that. I think it was very beneficial for me. But when I re-entered and tried to get work again after 3 or 4 years in the mid to late 60s, in the late 60s, I found it very difficult to get work.
I saw one of your films, Psych Out, that was set in San Francisco. And you play kind of a suave hippie. Who has lines like, reality is rotten and reality is deadly. Was this a...
I was dead broke, and I had to work, and that came along, and I didn't like the role at all. I hated it, but I had to do it.
Yeah, same with films like Werewolf of Washington?
Well, no, that I actually liked a great deal going in, and I thought it was a wonderful project of political comedy and satire, but the film got ruined in the making.
In what way?
Well, it got botched.
Oh. Huh.
I mean, I don't want to lay it on anyone's door.
Yeah.
But it did. It got ruined. You know, when we start into projects, we have to have a lot of faith in everybody because a lot of people are involved in making a film. And there are times when all the elements look right, and then when you see the finished product, it doesn't make it, and it's devastating. It's very disappointing. Then other times, case in point being the two films you just mentioned, Tucker and Married to the Mob, it does work out right, and they come out beautifully, and then the gratification is indescribable.
Are you able to accept the faith and the support of people in the movie business now as a man in your 50s easier than when you were in your 20s or even as a young boy?
Yeah, in my 20s I was still suffering from the way I'd felt about it as a child, and I couldn't really appreciate my own work or take any satisfaction from it. It wasn't until my late 30s and 40s that I began to really come to terms with that I was an actor, that it was not a useless or bad thing to be, and there was some value in it, and that I could appreciate it for myself.
My guest is Dean Stockwell. He plays the Mafia Don Tony Russo in the new film Married to the Mob. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Dean Stockwell is my guest. He began his acting career at the age of 6 and made 55 films. His latest is Jonathan Demme's Married to the Mob, which will open on August 19th. You once wanted to play the role of Prince Myshkin in Dostoevsky's The Idiot. Are you drawn to Russian literature and some of those darker visions of life?
Some of the great classic Russian literature, I think, is the finest that's ever been written. And I have found myself drawn to Tolstoy and Dostoevsky and Pushkin. Not any more than I've been drawn to great American literature or English literature. I love fine literature. The darker aspects, that's one aspect of life. I'm both drawn to the lighter and the darker. Actually, my preferences lie with the lighter, but that's rarely seen because I don't get too many opportunities to do work on the lighter side. And that's another reason why I'm so fond of Married to the Mob, because it's a comedy. It's a romantic comedy.
What would be another example of a light role that you'd like to do, a comic role? Is there a... I've heard that you're associated with a project called Ronnie Rocket.
I'm hoping that Ronnie Rocket will get some financing. That's a David Lynch project, a script that David wrote. And I can't, in all honesty, tell you that is a light on the light side. It's neither the light nor the dark. It's on the surrealist side. This is modern-day surrealism, just as Blue Velvet was, but it's even stranger. It's even farther out, not in a psychosexual way, but in terms of new and inventive images and context. It's mind-boggling. It's so strange, but it's wonderful, and there are a lot of funny things in it. But it's going to take someone with some courage to produce it.
Just because it is such an off-the-wall project?
Yes, that's right, yeah. That's great.
Your film, Boy with Green Hair, was a political film, had a pacifist theme. You were also in a film called Alcindo and the Condor, set in Nicaragua. Are you also interested in political themes in film work?
Yes, but as I'm trying to say, I don't have the opportunity to say, I would like to do this project or I would like to do that project. The things come. Do you want to do this one? You know, and that's the only thing that comes, mm-hmm. right? Over a period of 3-4 months, I'm sitting there with my family, and finally I get a call, and we're sending a script. And I read it, and that's what it is. And I say, yes, I'll do it, because, you know, I have to provide for my family. And it turns out to be Blue Velvet or Paris, Texas, or Gardens of Stone, or To Live and Die in L.A., or Married to the Mob. I can never tell what it's going to be.
Would you like to be on the other end of that, being able to generate projects? Or are you comfortable accepting projects as they just happen to come your way?
Well, the way it's working out, I'm very comfortable, yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's working just very, very well right now.
For some time, you didn't feel good about your work. You trashed some of your acting awards.
Yeah, I did. I was a little bombed one night, and I burned some scrolls from the Cannes Festival in the fireplace. My reason for doing it at the time was they weren't very attractive Skrulls.
Had nothing to do with how you were feeling about them, other than
well,
they were ugly.
I'm sure the subtext was that, as I've told you, that I didn't feel good about my career and I hadn't come to terms with it. But that has changed in recent years when I married and decided to raise a family. Mm-hmm. Now I save everything for my kids. Now I don't, you know, I don't think it's bad that they have a father who was an actor. Can't do anything about it, but I mean, I think they'll get some enjoyment out of it.
You sound like you're a survivor, that you've been able to, you know, quit Hollywood, quit the film business, come back, and now because you're dedicated to your family and through the interests of directors like David Lynch and Jonathan Demme, I mean, you have a whole new career, a whole new life again.
Yeah, that's the way it looks, and I'm really grateful. I feel I'm doing my best work now, and things are all, like, coming together the way one would say they should, you know, but it doesn't happen very often, and here it's happening.
You were a cute lad, a very handsome leading man, and now...
That's better now.
You're maturing. I mean, are you feeling comfortable with your appearance? Have you let any sort of... you know, the screen looks have changed. You're now
I think I look all right. I don't concern myself with it that much. My work comes from inside. You can't change your looks. At least the guys can't too much, unless you're Michael Jackson. But, no, I just let my looks hang out there and work internally. Because you can pick someone for how they look, and if they don't have talent as an actor, forget about it.
Do you think you'll ever have a need to sell real estate?
No, thank God. I don't think I ever really could have done that successfully. I was intending to, in all honesty, but I didn't have to. And I really think it would have been very, very difficult for me.
Well, thank you very much for coming in and spending this time
thank
with us
you.
On Fresh Air today.
Thank you, my boy.
Dean Stockwell plays the Mafia Don, Tony the Tiger Russo, in Jonathan Demme's new film, Married to the Mob. He also appears in the film Tucker as Howard Hughes. I'm Sag Thompson, and this is Fresh Air.
She
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional funding comes from World of Travel Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner, designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Fresh Air receives additional support from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, science writer James Glick tells us about chaos, as revolutionary theory explains why nature is filled with random patterns and why there are myriad opportunities for things to take unexpected turns. But you knew that. Also today, commentator Maureen Corrigan leafs through Writing Red, a new anthology of women writers of the 1930s. Much of this powerful writing has been long neglected. And rhythm guitarist Marty Gross pays tribute to Chicago, the city he ran away to when he was just starting out. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Lori Waffenschmidt. Edwin Meese left office today as Attorney General of the United States. Before stepping down, he signed an order to allow special prosecutors to investigate members of Congress, similar to the way executive branch officials are treated under the Ethics in Government Act. Meese has been investigated by two independent counsels since coming to Washington. He resigned as Attorney General after a special prosecutor decided not to press criminal charges developed against Meese. Meese once tried to have the Ethics in Government Act declared unconstitutional. He said he acted on his final day as head of the Justice Department to ensure that legislators and top executive branch officials be treated equally. Richard Thornburgh took the oath of office today at the White House to become the nation's 76th Attorney General. The former Pennsylvania governor promised to make drug trafficking and drug abuse public enemy number one, and he listed his other priorities.
Only a few months ago, Environmental Protection Agency officials rejected calls from environmental groups to crack down on the herbicide 2,4-D because, EPA said, there's
organized crime and racketeering, official corruption, and white-collar crime, as well as to protecting the first civil right of every American, the right to be free from fear in our homes, on our streets, and in our communities.
Thornburgh headed the Justice Department's Criminal Division during the Ford administration in the mid-1970s and established the Public Integrity Section that prosecutes corrupt public officials. Wholesale prices rose 0.5% last month. The Labor Department reports that for the year to date, the Producer Price Index has gone up at a 3.9% annual rate. Michael Richards has details.
Much of the inflation on the wholesale level last month came from increases in the cost of many everyday items like soap, detergent, clothing, cosmetics, and drugs. But increases in food costs were not as high as they were earlier in the drought. Energy prices were mixed, with gasoline costing more, but fuel oil and natural gas prices going down. Dirk Van Dungen of the National Association of Wholesaler Distributors says he sees inflation moderating in the coming months because these latest statistics show the costs dropping for raw materials manufacturers use to produce other products.
That suggests perhaps that some things have peaked, and that as those crude figures work their way down in the fixed goods, they'll have a dampening effect in months ahead.
Another positive factor keeping the cost of doing business down is that in July, the price for capital goods, those things businesses need to operate, rose just a scant 0.1%. And analysts say that should also help hold the line on consumer prices as well. For National Public Radio, this is Michael Richards in Washington.
A new National Cancer Institute study, which has not yet been published, shows that farmers who use the popular herbicide 2,4-D have a significantly higher risk of getting cancer than those who don't. NPR's Daniel Swerdling reports.
Only a few months ago, Environmental Protection Agency officials rejected calls from environmental groups to crack down on the herbicide 2,4-D because, EPA said, there's no good evidence that using the chemical causes cancer. Even though the National Cancer Institute had reported in 1986 that Kansas farmers who used 2,4-D had higher risks of getting the disease. But today, researcher Aaron Blair, who directed the Cancer Institute study, said the latest findings make a compelling case, in his words, that using the nation's fourth most widely used weed killer does lead to cancer. The researchers studied more than 200 Nebraska farmers this time who had a rare form of the disease. And they found that farmers who used the chemical at least 20 times a year had more than 3 times the risk of getting the cancer as farmers who didn't. Some consumer groups have raised questions about the weed killer because it's widely sold in home, garden, and lawn products, too. Today, cancer researcher Blair said his study didn't look carefully at consumer use of 2,4-D, but he said the findings suggest that anybody who uses 2,4-D a lot, whether at home or on the farm, is taking chances. I'm Daniel Swerdling in Washington.
On Wall Street today, the Dow fell nearly 2 points. This is NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. When he was a kid, Marty Gross began fooling around with an old Hawaiian ukulele, which he found in the attic of his New York City home. Soon his interest turned to the guitar and to jazz. And during the 40s, when Charlie Christian's single-line electric guitar style was having a great influence on the jazz of the time, Marty was drawn more to the shuffle rhythm of swing band acoustic guitarists. Today, he's one of the few players still playing jazz acoustic rhythm guitar. We invited Marty Gross and his guitar to our studios. He came up with a couple of songs related to the cities he's lived in since he began his career.
Chicago, Chicago, that toddling town. Chicago, Chicago, I'll show you around. Bet your bottom dollar you'll lose your blues in Chicago. The town that Mayor Daley could not shut down. Bet your bottom dollar, State Street, that great street. I just want to say, they do things they don't do on Broadway. Say, you'll have the time of your life. I saw a man, he danced with his wife in Chicago. Chicago, my hometown. That great street, I just want to say, they do things they don't do on Broadway. Say, you'll have the time of your life. I saw a man, he danced with his wife in Chicago, in Chicago, in Chicago, my hometown. Yes, Chicago. Chicago was a place where I ran away to when I was 18 years old. Tried to make my fame and fortune. I made neither, but I had a pretty good time because there were a lot of jazz joints, a lot of places to sit in. There were some places that had very long hours, and the musicians would let almost anybody, even the most unskilled neophyte like myself, play just in order to get some time off from being on the bandstand. And that was great experience. There were a lot of good years in Chicago. I worked all kinds of saloons. I worked in places where girls swung on swings. I worked in places where every night was billed as New Year's Eve, and it was a great convention town. You played long hours and you played hard, but when you were young, that was good training. After a while, I came back to New York, and I'd like to do a New York song, but all the New York songs are so, most of them, are so cliched by now. They're so overdone that I'd like to do this one, which is about a place in New York. It was featured in the 1920s Ziegfeld Follies by Fanny Brice. I didn't know until later in my life that Fanny Brice had been a stand-up vaudeville entertainer and a theater entertainer and the toast of Broadway, because, of course, in the early 40s, Fanny Brice was known through a radio program called Baby Snooks, and all we ever heard of her, she played the part of a little 2 or 3 year old Muppet who said things like, "Why, Daddy? And I fall down and go boom," and had lines like that. And it was totally a different character that was revealed later on to be the Fanny Brice that sang this song and made it a hit in those days, called Rosa Washington Square. She's the rose of Washington Square. She's wilting down there in basement air. They ask her to pose with or without her clothes. They say her Roman nose just seems to please particular people both. She's got plenty of those in secondhand clothes and nice long hair. She's got those Broadway vampires lashed to the mast. She's got no future. Ah, what a past. She's the rose of Washington Square. Bows, she's got plenty of those in secondhand clothes and nice long hair. She's got those Broadway vampires lashed to the mast. She's got no future. What a pass. She's the rose of Washington Square. She's the rose of Washington Square. Rose of Washington Square.
Rhythm guitarist Marty Gross, who lives in upstate New York, his recent recording, Marty Gross and the Keepers of the Flame, is on the Stomp Off label. This is Fresh Air. There may be chaos in your life, but hey, don't worry, you're not alone. Chaos is all around you. Chaos is also a recent scientific theory to explain the complexity and randomness in the natural world. It's not an easy theory to explain, but science writer James Gleick has been doing just that. His book Chaos has captured the imagination of a wide range of scientists, meteorologists, geologists, mathematicians, as well as non-scientists. Those lay readers have helped to keep the book on the New York Times bestseller list for 25 weeks. I'd been reading the book and wanted the opportunity to explore some of the ideas of chaos with Gleick. But first, let's get a definition of chaos.
Chaos is several things. First of all, it's exactly what you think. It's disorder, it's turbulence, it's the erratic and unpredictable behavior of all sorts of complex systems, from the weather to turbulent waves in the ocean, to ripples in a stream, to the behavior of the human brain, or the arrhythmic behavior of the human heart in distress. All of those things are examples of chaos. But chaos has also become the name for a real turning point in the development of science in this century. One physicist likes to say that where particle physicists are exploring the fundamentals of matter, chaos is exploring the fundamentals of motion and coming up with a whole new vocabulary, a whole new menagerie of structures and pictures to explain just what the building blocks of motion are, the building blocks of dynamics.
Now, this seems to be a radical change in the history of science, then, because I get the sense that scientists in the past have been concerned with precision in numbers, in predictable events. And it seems that this idea of chaos means that all that's out the window.
Well, yes and no. Chaos doesn't mean that scientists aren't concerned with precision anymore. And in a sense, they're more concerned than ever with the problem of predictability. But what you're saying is exactly right, that for a long time, without even being conscious of it, many scientists concentrated on systems that were orderly, systems that behaved well, systems that didn't break down into the sort of turbulent behavior that I'm talking about. And the reason they concentrated on systems like that is the most understandable reason of all. Those systems could be dealt with. You could make calculations about simple systems, and yet often the very same systems had lurking within them the potential for chaotic behavior.
Now, what's an example of a system that is affected by chaos?
Well, in a way, the best example is the weather, because that's the system that gave chaos its first big push in the early 60s. We all know now that the weather is a chaotic system. We know it because we're smart enough not to believe anything a weather forecaster tells us about what the weather is going to be like 6 or 7 days into the future. Most of the time, the forecasters don't even bother with that. It wasn't always so. That is, people didn't always have that kind of deep-rooted suspicion. In fact, in the late 50s and 60s, there was a tremendous amount of optimism about the possibilities for weather forecasting. The reason for it was weather obeys Newton's laws. It obeys laws of science that had been well understood for the better part of a century. So it seemed as though it was just a matter of calculation. You get the best data you can about the state of the weather right now or at any given instant, and then you do some arithmetic, and you get a new state of the weather at some time in the future, and you repeat this thing over and over again, and voila, you have a weather forecast. But it doesn't work as people hoped 20 years ago it would, and chaos is the reason.
And part of this leads to something that chaos theorists call the butterfly effect, which means that a butterfly flapping its wings in Beijing can affect the weather in New York? Is that why we're having our heat wave?
The heat wave actually may be an example of another kind of chaos in weather viewed in the longer term. The butterfly effect is exactly what you say, and it's one of those things that's almost hard to accept as literal truth. You wonder, is that just supposed to be a metaphor? But in fact, it's literally true. The tiniest disturbance in the atmosphere creates a level of uncertainty that multiplies very rapidly, so that it is now known to be impossible to make a perfect deterministic weather forecast for, say, 4 weeks in the future. It's just impossible.
I want to say that in many ways it sounds almost like we're talking about a post-Monty Python. Chaos as a science sounds very Python-esque.
It does. It's hard to believe that that's really the name of a field of science, isn't it? But that's the name that it was given by a mathematician named Jim York in, I guess it was 1974 or so, and it stuck.
One of the things that's startling about this theory is that it ties together chemical reactions, wildlife populations decline and rise, electronic circuitry, the behavior of the human heart, the notion of how cells behave, all seems to come down to this very sort of simple idea that erratic behavior appears to be random but is not. And it seems very close in many ways to the world of art, where the scientific idea had once been predictability, and now we're in a world where anything can happen. It seems almost much more artistic, as if art and science are merging in some ways.
Some of the scientists who I talk to who like to speculate somewhat unscientifically about matters of this kind do think about art. A lot of people talk, for example, about the change in taste in art that we've seen in the latter part of this century, away from the Bauhaus school of architecture, very clean, simple geometric lines, away from the simple color squares of Albers, for example, toward... And this is really a return to older ideas of art, in a sense, but toward more complex forms.
You've developed what seems to be a reputation as the one who is explaining the theory of chaos to the rest of the world. You've been writing on this subject for the New York Times since, I think, at least 1984, and you've written this book about it. What's the curiosity about chaos for you?
Well, I stumbled across it, as you say, in 1984 when I wrote a magazine article about a brilliant young physicist named Mitchell Feigenbaum, who made some of the pioneering discoveries in chaos. And I began to realize, the more I explored this subject, how rich a subject it was. And it struck me that this was an opportunity to take a piece of scientific history in the making, talk to the participants, find out what motivated them, what what uncertainties they'd faced, what their problems were, while their memories were still fresh.
Have you found these scientists who are working with Chaos articulate, able to articulate to you?
Like other brilliant scientists, it's a very mixed group. I've come to the realization that a scientist's brilliance or his greatness has really nothing to do one way or the other with his ability to talk about his work in terms that a layman can understand. There are some great scientists who can do that and some great scientists who can't. And the challenge is in learning to talk to both groups of people.
Do you get letters from readers who say, I've read your book, I like the ideas, but I don't get it all?
Yes, certainly. I get that kind of letter. I get letters from readers who say, I like your book, I don't get it all, but I've always been curious about such and such a thing. It might be watching the tide come in on the beach and form pools and ripple in a certain way. And it seems to me that maybe that's an example of chaos. I love getting that kind of mail from people who are curious about the world they live in. And I love getting another kind of mail, which has really taken me by surprise, which is mail from people who studied science at one time or may have worked in science and were frustrated by the feeling that they were seeing something in their experiments, some sort of disorderly behavior. But when they reported it to the people they were supposed to be working for, they were told, no, it doesn't work that way. We know that this system can't behave in that way. That's just a little experimental error. That's just a little fluff. Don't worry about that. And some of these people have retained over periods of 10 and 20 years a frustration at being treated that way. And they've read about the new ideas of chaos and realized that there was something there all along to be explored.
James Glick is the author of the book Chaos. Last month, Glick left his job as a science writer for the New York Times to write a biography of physicist Richard Feynman. This is Fresh Air. Coming up later today on National Public Radio, All Things Considered, and with me on the line in Washington is co-host Robert Siegel. What have you on the table for us today?
Well, we have news from Burma, where the military leader who took over a couple of weeks ago, Sein Lwin, has stepped down. We're not quite sure under what circumstances, but there has been a huge nationwide uprising against against his leadership. Also, we talk with Linda Wertheimer down in New Orleans, curtain raiser on the Republican National Convention, which begins next week. And a court order said that a high school student out in California did not have to dissect a frog unless it died of natural causes. And do you know what we do today?
It sounds like you're going to have a cooking show as
no.
well. No?
We've sent the intrepid Alex Chadwick to find a frog that's died of natural causes.
All that and more coming up on All Things Considered here on National Public Radio. Whole chapters of our literary history have been left behind. Commentator Maureen Corrigan has a review of an anthology of women's writing from the 1930s, poetry, fiction, and journalism excavated after half a century.
Writing Red is a powerful anthology of women's political writing of the 1930s. The idea for it came to editors Charlotte Nicola and Paula Rabinowitz 8 years ago when they were graduate students at the University of Michigan. They had enrolled in a seminar on the writing of the Great Depression and noticed that none of the assigned authors was a woman. Didn't any women write about the hunger marches, labor strikes, and radical politics of the decade? The professor couldn't think of any. After all, historians have focused on the suffragist and birth control movements at the beginning of this century, implying that women did not engage in public discourse again until the feminist movement of the 60s. Nicola and Rabinowitz began digging for political writing by women during the 30s and were lucky enough to get research support from novelist Toni Morrison. In the musty pages of Communist Party periodicals like The New Masses and Working Woman, and black journals like Opportunity and Crisis, they struck the motherlode. They found hundreds of stories, poems, and pieces of analysis and reporting by women. Subjects ranged from the Spanish Civil War and Chinese revolutionary activity to strikes in cotton mills and garment factories and the sexual politics of the home and the workplace. Some of the authors in Writing Red are well known: Josephine Herbst, Tilly Olson, but over half the pieces were written by black and white working-class women. For reasons of academic elitism or just plain laziness, working-class writers have been left out of even the most recent feminist literary histories. The upshot is that Virginia Woolf's 1928 essay on work, A Room of One's Own, seems to be reprinted monthly, while Ramona Lowe's story, The Woman in the Window, appeared in the journal Opportunity in 1940, then sunk into the archives until Nicola and Rabinowitz unearthed it. Woolf's essay eloquently argues for the right of middle-class women to work, but Lowe's story is a strong statement about women who have no choice but to work. Lowe's main character, Mrs. Jackson, makes $15 a week as a restaurant cook. To keep her job, she obeys the boss's orders that she dress up like Aunt Jemima and fry chicken in a sidewalk window, a living ad for Mammy's down-home cooking. Lowe's writes, "She leaned against the table and looked out, and the world looked in, curiously, at the embodiment of a fiction it had created." Later on, Mrs. Jackson's children see her, she's humiliated, and the next day, she goes back to work. Though they're influenced by popular romances and melodramas, none of the stories in Writing Red have happy endings. These pieces try to stir readers to action, not lull them with fantasy. If good literature must be universal, as mainstream critics tell us, then the stories and poems in Writing Red aren't very good. They overflow with too many details about 30-cent-an-hour wages and 12-hour days. If good journalism should be objective, then pieces like Vivian Dahl's Them Women Sure Are Scrappers about the 1934 strike at the Seabrook Cannery are lousy examples of reporting. Dahl herself was jailed twice for punching the cops breaking up the picket lines. But if good writing should make people's everyday struggles and possibilities vivid, then the pieces in Writing Red are terrific. Luckily, editors Nicola and Rabinowitz are scrappers too. Their fight was worth it. Writing Red shows that women writers have a radical tradition of their own, a tradition full of energy and humor to be proud of and to continue.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Bryn Mawr College and reviews books for the Village Voice. She reviewed Writing Red, that's R-E-D, edited by Charlotte Nicola and Paulette Rabinowitz. It's published by Feminist Press. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. On the next show, Terry Gross will speak with author Andrew Holleran about his new collection of essays, Ground Zero. He's thought about gay lifestyles before and after the AIDS epidemic. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead guides us through a recently reissued record by Duke Ellington. Based on Ellington's State Department tour of the Orient in 1963, it's called Far Eastern Suite. And catch a review of the TV movie Gotham about a private eye hired to track down a woman who may be a ghost. I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Deborah Beagle. Our engineer is Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Our theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. Terry Gross returns from vacation for the next show. It's been a treat working with this splendid staff. I'm Sedge Thompson. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.